Begin today with a work session on Senate Bill 887. Senator Brown, would you like to? Okay.
And Madam Vice Chair, or Madam Chairman, I think it's appropriate today.
She's not Madam Vice anymore.
I always stumble over that.
We need a public hearing on
this. Yeah, clarify, we did a public hearing. It was a tap hearing. So I think it was contemplated that we do some testimony today. I don't know if there was a sign-up sheet, but if anyone wants to testify that's not on a list that Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission sent up here, please let Jane know if you'd like to testify. So we just did a tap, and this is the bill, Madam Chair, that deals with a juvenile psychiatric security review board. Very briefly, case law has found that there is a right to use an affirmative defense of mental disease or defect in juvenile court, and that has been the case for some time. In juvenile court, there has not been a procedure on what to do with those young people. I think typically those cases have been on a delinquency case, a case where a youth has committed an act that would constitute a crime. Those cases have been shifted to a dependency case. And this bill from the Oregon Law Commission, it's a substantial bill, goes through what basically makes that a statutory right of the ability to raise an affirmative defense, goes through the findings that must be made by the court, and then goes through basically a second tier of if that affirmative defense is found, if a young person can prove that they are have a mental disease or defect, and the same legal standards are used to define that, which would be, you know, that they cannot recognize the right or wrong, basically, of their acts. If that is found, and there's found that there's a serious mental condition, which is also a new concept, or that the young person is a danger to others, they would then go, there'd be a mechanism for jurisdiction to be transferred to this psychiatric review board. And that then basically the bill goes through issues like how long they should be in the hospital, if they're going to be in the hospital, when conditional discharge to another managing entity or agency is to be done. And so I wanted to give you a brief overview, and then I'm sure there's people that could explain it a lot better here in the hearing room.
Thank you, Senator Brown.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair and committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I'd like to turn it over to Dave Kanegi, who's the Executive Director of the Law Commission, for the outset, and then I have a few remarks to make.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Burdick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Kanegi. I'm Associate Dean at the Willamette University College of Law and serve as Executive Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I want this morning, because I'm confident you're familiar with the work of the Commission generally, to simply address two points. First, why this particular bill was a project taken on by the Oregon Law Commission, because that will give you some insight into the heart of the bill and why it's needed and why it came up as a matter of concern for the Law Commission. And then secondly, I'd like to simply introduce a very simple concept embedded in the notion of law reform, and then return the comments to Senator Brown. First, why did the Oregon Law Commission take up this project? And the answer turns on the question that was initially presented to our commission. And the question is this. If a youth in a delinquency proceeding raises the defense of mental disease or defect, in effect the insanity defense, and if that defense succeeds, then here's the question, what do we do with that individual? Now, in the adult setting, we have an answer, and it's called the PSRB. In the juvenile setting, however, we were presented at the Law Commission with what I'd like to describe as an institutional design gap, a gap in the institutions of government that attend to the answer to that particular question. And that gap is what this bill attempts to fill by bringing the concept of a PSRB already in place for adults into the juvenile context. My second point is this: why the Law Commission also turns on the importance of law reform revision and improvement when institutional gaps such as this are identified. The problem is that when a gap in institutional design exists, there is what we'll call dispositional uncertainty. That is, we don't know what to do with the individual who raises the defense and succeeds. And because of that institutional uncertainty, here is the core of the problem. It creates a restraining or chilling effect on those individuals who would otherwise raise this constitutionally available defense. They withhold the exercise of that right because if exercising it, one does not know institutionally what the outcome will necessarily be. Again, that because of the institutional design gap in the absence of a PSRB for juveniles. And so for basic institutional design reasons and for good law reform reasons relating to certainty in the law, allowing counsel to bargain thoughtfully in advance in the shadow of certainty in the law, the Oregon Law Commission gladly took on this project over 2 years ago, worked through the interim with individuals under Senator Brown's guidance in a work group, the details of which I'd like Senator Brown to address in terms of those who participated and those who will be appearing before you here today. Thank you for this opportunity to testify and to consider this important law reform measure as an institutional design change that would fill an existing gap. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maybe we should hold questions until Senator Brown has done her presentation. Welcome, Senator Brown.
Thank you, and good morning, Madam Vice Chair and committee members. I am very appreciative of the fact that you're willing to give this bill a hearing. There have been probably thousands of hours spent in creating Senate Bill 887. From your work report, you will note that the number of people included on the subcommittee include folks like Mary Claire Buckley, who's here today. She's the director of the PSRB, Kathy Berger from the Juvenile Rights Project, Helen Smith and Amy Holmes-Hain from the Linn County DA's office, folks from the Oregon Youth Authority, Judge Darling from Clackamas Circuit Court, Muriel Goldman, whom I'm sure many of you are familiar with, Bob Jundev with the Oregon Advocacy Center. So there were a number of folks representing a number of organizations participating in this work group. And I have to tell you that Virginia Vanderbilt gave this bill her all. I know that she spent at least one day up in Portland working with the drafting group and spent countless hours producing the product you have in front of her. So in addition to thanking all of the volunteers, I want to thank Virginia because she just did outstanding work on this bill. This, keep in mind, a juvenile code is a subcommittee of the juvenile code rewrite. So in addition to the subcommittee, all of our 40 to 55 members on the juvenile code rewrite committee has been through this bill a number of times, and we've had to undergo the scrutiny of former Justice Hans Lindsay at the Oregon Law Commission in addition to other commission members. So we've been through the ringer. At the outset, there was a struggle about sort of what system was appropriate to address the needs of these youths. I think it's fair to say that a large number, at least a vocal number of the subcommittee, wanted to approach it from a DHS, a human services model. Obviously, some of the other members of the group wanted to approach it from a criminal angle, the Oregon Youth Authority angle. I think after working with the Law Commission and working with commission members, I felt very strongly that it needed to come under a new framework, and that's how we came up with a juvenile PSRB, Juveniles Psychiatric Security Review Board. I did not feel, and I think a lot of my committee members agreed, that the Department of Human Services or the juvenile dependency system was an appropriate system to handle these youths from a public safety standpoint. Did not feel like the services to children and families and the dependency system had the adequate resources and the adequate dollars to be able to make sure that the public was kept safe. at the same token, we felt like the Oregon Youth Authority or a delinquency model was not appropriate for meeting the level of needs that these young people have. And so we feel like we've come up with a fairly appropriate model here, which essentially steals the adult psychiatric security review board model and puts it into the juvenile system. I can't tell you there's no opposition to the bill. There's going to be some concerns raised. I will tell you that mainly I see the concerns being raised are fiscal in nature. I would make the argument to the committee that if we don't have a process in place, as Dave so eloquently noted, that we are, it's very likely that we as a state will get sued for violating these youth constitutional rights. And that with the approach we have developed, the juvenile PSRB, we have the ability to access federal dollars. So I think this makes a lot of sense. It is still a work in progress, but I encourage, urge, beg, plead you to move this bill to Ways and Means where we can address the fiscal concerns there and keep moving forward. I did want to mention we don't anticipate that this bill will apply to a large number of youths. I think the number that folks have in mind is either one handful or two. So we're not talking huge numbers, but we do feel very strongly about making sure that these youth's constitutional rights are being protected. And with that, I would like to ask that the other folks that are going to testify to come on up. We would be happy to answer any questions, but I can tell you that the certified SMART folks behind me can do a much better job of that than either I, and no offense, right. Dave.
Absolutely.
Well, maybe we will take the hint. Thank you very much. And move on to the next panel, which is Mary Claire Buckley, Kathy Berger, and Amy Holmes Haynes.
Good morning.
And did Senator Brown, did you want Carrie Rasmussen to come up with this panel or separately? All right, proceed. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Vice Chair. Kathy Berger from Juvenile Rights Project. As the committee council let the committee know, juveniles in Oregon have a right to assert mental disease and defect offenses. This was found by the Oregon Court of Appeals in 1976 that juveniles had the same right as adults to present any defense based on their constitutional right towards due process. But the juvenile code has been silent about what to do with someone who successfully asserts the defense. And what happens right now is kind of based on the act, which would be a crime if the person was adult, but the juvenile is alleged to have committed. If we're talking about a low-level offense and somebody asserts the defense, right now what happens and the defense is successful is the petition gets changed to a dependency case and it's handled through the child welfare system. The problem comes when you have the more serious offense, which would raise anybody's concern about putting a juvenile with a serious, with a mental disease or defect and who has committed what would be a very serious crime if they were an adult, murder, the very serious sex crimes, arson, serious assaults. At that point, the concern becomes also a very high public safety concern. And to get the person into a system where there's the public safety aspect, they have to, the judicial officers would basically have to deny the defense to get them into the Oregon Youth Authority, because if someone asserts a defense and is successful, they cannot have the same dispositional outcome as somebody who never asserted the defense. So if somebody asserts the defense and is successful, they can't go into the Oregon Youth Authority because they cannot be found essentially guilty or within the jurisdiction of the court on this delinquent act. And that's where the problem comes, is you have to have something, some different disposition that occurs for somebody that asserts the defense. We looked at several other options, as Senator Brown mentioned. We looked at whether we could put this directly into the child welfare system, into the dependency system, but certainly the public safety concerns that then get raised. And we looked at whether we could expand the Oregon Youth Authorities to include these youth, but maybe just not send them to a youth correctional facility. Both of those have significant problems, and when we looked through, we also looked at other states throughout the United States to see what they were doing, and it was kind of a mishmash of what other states were doing. And finally, we settled on the fact that we do have a system right now in place in the criminal system that works, that has a high degree of respect from both the district attorneys, the judges, and the defense counsel, and so that's why we decided to look at the PSRB model. As Senator Brown mentioned, there is a concern about the number of youth that we'd be talking about who would be able to successfully assert the defense. We have been working with a number of 10 a year that we figure would be able to successfully assert the defense. How we came up with that number is we took the rate of successful assertion of a mental disease, the insanity defense in the adult system, we doubled that success rate, and then we applied it to the number of delinquency cases that go through the juvenile system every year. So what we're talking about when we're talking about 10 kids is it comes, that means that children would have to be twice as successful as adults. And you have to remember that for youth 15 years or older who commit one of the 22 Measure 11 offenses, they are automatically tried as an adult, so those youth are taken out because they're eligible for the PSRB through the criminal system. So we're talking about youth that in some cases could be up to 17 years old, but in some cases only up to 14 years old, depending upon the crimes that they're alleged to have committed. So that's significant. In addition, the way we've worked the defense is not every youth who successfully asserts an insanity defense in juvenile court would automatically go under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. What we tried to do is look at the kids that could not adequately be served by either DHS through the child welfare system or OIA through the juvenile justice system and try to capture those youth. The ones that have the high public safety, that give us the high public safety concerns, but also have the serious mental health issues. And those are the youth that we tried to put under the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We acknowledge that these youth, these 10 youth that we're talking about, are a very small problem of the number of seriously mentally ill juveniles that find their way into our juvenile justice system every year. If you look at the statistics from the Oregon Youth Authority, there's large numbers of youth that they have in close custody that have very serious mental health issues that the Oregon Youth Authority struggles with trying to deal with and trying to treat. However, what we felt is that the Oregon Law Commission made it very clear to us that they wanted us to focus not on that large problem of the mentally ill youth in the juvenile justice system, but to focus on getting a dispositional alternative to for the youth that are successful in asserting the insanity defense so we can maintain and protect those youth's constitutional rights.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Amy Holmes-Hain. I'm the Senior Deputy DA supervising the juvenile unit of the Multnomah County DA's office. I've been in that position for 7 years, and I've been a Deputy DA since 1987. And I think it's fair to say that if this bill passes, and we do support it, the biggest impact around the state would probably be felt in our county just because of the numbers of referrals that make it to our system every year. I think it's also fair to say that our county has more experience than any other county in the state with dealing with seriously mentally ill youths in juvenile court. What I want to do is explain why our office is so supportive of this bill. I'll try not to repeat things that Ms. Osborne's already said, but it's hard to do that because I think we all feel here essentially the same basic reasons for support of the bill. One of the things I want to do right away is, again, as Ms. Berger did, is to... Did I call you Osborne before? I'm sorry. These marriages. Is that it does not create a new defense. And I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions floating around, that somehow this creates a right that youths in juvenile court did not have before. They have had this right by case law and constitutional law for some time. The problem has been that the code is simply silent on what the response is for the court and for the parties if the defense is successfully asserted.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Chair? I've heard this now several times, mm-hmm. and Ms. Berger said that this, in 1976, the Court of Appeals said juveniles can present this defense. So I'm just surprised that since 1976, we've not had a juvenile who has challenged what you've failed to do for them in the system based on this defense.
I'll let Ms. Berger answer that question.
As a defense attorney, I actually have asserted this defense a couple of times. Basically, what has happened is that for the less serious crimes, usually we can work out some kind of disposition. When you get to the more serious crimes, what happens is that judicial officers will not allow the defense because when it comes right down to it, they know that there is no dispositional alternative other than sending the youth to the child welfare system. And when they have the public safety concerns, they then say, I'm going to find the youth within the jurisdiction of the court, send the youth to the Oregon Youth Authority, where I know that the public will be safe and they'll get treatment. And so the defense essentially is denied by the judge. That's a difficult appeal to make, it's a difficult appellate issue because... if a judge is going to do that and know that they are going to deny the defense is extremely hard to prove in the first place. And then when you have a judicial finding saying that the person, the mental disease or defect that the person has did not cause them to either not be able to conform their behavior or understand what the difference between right and wrong, which is what the insanity defense boils down to, that's a difficult challenge to make because the Court of Appeals is essentially bound by, to some extent, the judge's findings on those. So the appellate issues don't happen.
Okay, that answers the question. I can see why we need to have...
And also on a defense attorney point, it's difficult for me to be able to tell families and my clients what would happen if we did assert the defense. This might happen, this might happen, this might happen. So oftentimes I can only assert the defense if my client wants me to. A court cannot assert the defense for a client. So when there's that dispositional question, a lot of times the families and my clients are looking for more certainty and will want the certainty rather than the up in the air, we're not sure what's going to happen.
If I can just follow up a little bit on those comments, I don't think that this bill will necessarily result in a huge number of additional youths asserting the defense than asserted them before. Because, as Ms. Berger said, historically, one of the reasons why the defense hasn't been asserted is that it's really impossible to counsel clients on what the outcome is going to be if they're successful in asserting the defense. If this bill passes, it will be easier to assert or to explain to youths and their families what the potential outcome will be. But the potential outcome is not necessarily less onerous than if the defense is not asserted, because if the youth falls under the jurisdiction of the PSRB, the PSRB has the authority to direct that the youth be hospitalized until they are treated to a point where public safety is no longer endangered by their mental illness and their behavior. And that could mean a much greater restriction of liberty than if they simply sort of helped the youth get through the system in spite of their mental illness, ended up adjudicated and on probation, where the worst that could happen to them is A's in detention or potentially confinement in a youth correction facility. But even, you know, given the current landscape where, you know, we're seeing major cuts in the availability of youth correction beds, you know, most courts are not committing kids to youth correction system. So that's another reason why or another answer to the concern that there's going to be this huge run of kids wanting to leap up and assert this defense. It's hard to prove, number one, and number two, the outcome's not necessarily less restrictive of liberty than if the defense were not asserted.
And, Madam Chair, there's a follow-up question that came out of that. Let me ask you this question. If we have youth who really haven't been directed into the system where this would take us previously, did those youth go on to commit heinous adult crimes that could have been avoided had they received treatment?
I'm not aware of any particular instance like okay. that. These youths are in our system now. I think that's another misconception. These youths are in our system now, but where they are is either on probation when they shouldn't be, instead should be in a different system, or they're in the world of dependency, child welfare.
Okay.
And our view is that this bill is better than that system, or creates a system that's better than that system, because the child welfare system is really not equipped to deal with youths with mental health issues of this significance who also pose a risk to public safety. Mm-hmm. They do not view that as their mission. They don't necessarily have the expertise necessarily to adequately supervise those kids. They don't necessarily have the resources. And their focus has never really been public safety as their primary mission. So those kids are with us now. They're simply being handled by a system that we think isn't really adequately protective of the public safety issues.
Well, the kids from 1976, are they still with you?
No, they would have probably aged out of our system by now. And I don't have any specific instances of situations where those kids went on to do something really awful.
Thank you for answering the question.
I'll just continue and try to wrap up my my comments here. Some additional benefits that this bill would provide from the state's perspective are that currently, when the defense is asserted, there is no clear statutory entitlement for the state to get our own psychological evaluation of the youth if we disagree with the evaluation that the defense has presented. This bill would make that explicitly available to us. We don't have to get that evaluation if we don't want to or if we feel we can't afford it, but it makes it clear that we're entitled to one. Also, in giving the jurisdiction over the youth to the PSRB, they have the authority to intervene immediately if the youth under their jurisdiction is behaving in an unsafe way in the community or has decompensated and needs hospitalization. Under the dependency system that we have now, you would have to get back into court, which can be a slow process, and there's no real authority to intervene immediately to ensure public safety is protected. Finally, I think that another reason why PSRB jurisdiction is appropriate over this narrow class of youth is that they have demonstrated an historical level of expertise in dealing with very seriously mentally ill people and historically have demonstrated a true commitment to public safety as their primary mission. And so that's another reason why we support their jurisdiction over these youths. The alternative of the dependency system is a very variable system around the state. And so we can't ensure that there would be the quality, a consistent quality of oversight that would be necessary, we feel, to ensure public safety. One of the answer or the statements in opposition to this bill that I've heard, and this will be the last thing that I'll say, and then I'll pass it on to Ms. Claire Buckley, is that, well, why don't we just not really worry about the fact that these youths are entitled to the defense and just adjudicate them as delinquents, put them on probation, and send them to youth correction facilities? Well, obviously, from our perspective, that would be a denial of the youth's constitutional right to assert the defense, and it is not ethical, in my view, as a prosecutor, to seek to adjudicate someone and place them on probation or subject them to the youth correction facility if they are not competent. And so that's not an adequate answer. The other thing that I've heard is that, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. We're doing fine with these kids now. Unfortunately, there is no it. There is no it in the law. It's simply silent on what the response should be for the court to this class of kids. So that's all I have to say this morning. If you have questions, I'm happy to take them.
Thank you. Okay, Madam Buckley.
Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Claire Buckley, and I'm the Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. And my role this morning is to tell you a little bit about how the board would operate in this system that we're proposing. Under this statutory scheme, we see the juvenile panel of the board operating or functioning much like what the board does in the adult system now. Its primary purpose would continue to be to protect the public. Its mission would be to do that through the ongoing review of the progress of these youth and to make the determination of their appropriate placement, be that in a hospital, in the community, or an outright discharge. To make the best decisions in these cases, and frankly, to address the concern that we were basically imposing an adult solution to a juvenile problem, the work group was adamant that to address or to acknowledge that juveniles were different than adults, that a separate second panel of the board be created or established in this statute. And that panel would consist of professionals who are experienced with juveniles and their development. Thus, you will see that in this statutory scheme, we would still have a multidisciplinary panel, which we think is critical to the operation of the board and has been for 25 years, but that the governor would appoint a, for example, the psychiatrist would be either board certified or eligible in child psychiatry. We would have a child psychologist, a juvenile parole or probation officer, an attorney who's experienced in juvenile practice, and a member of the general public. The decisions that that panel would make, they would sit in panels of three and would hear cases, and those decisions would be made in a hearings process where the youth would have all due process rights afforded to him or her. The time frames for these hearings, the various types of hearings that are provided, are set out in the statute. And at each hearing, the board needs to make certain findings concerning their continuing jurisdiction, that the elements of the jurisdictional piece are met. And they also make the decision as to whether an individual, especially those who have initially been committed to a hospital or facility, whether they are ready to be placed into the community. I would tell you that when the professional treatment staff makes that recommendation to the board, at that time we then engage community mental health agencies, and we anticipate juvenile treatment providers in this process to make an independent assessment as to whether they believe that the child is ready to return to the community, and if so, what conditions should be placed on that child. That this recommendation would come back to the board. The board would issue an order that sets out the conditions upon which this child must abide by, and those often include where they live, their medication monitoring, their psychiatric treatment, in the case of juveniles, what education, what kind of treatment they'll be involved in, whether they're involved in schooling, what have you. And the board would issue that order as a result of the collaboration of the treatment providers in the whatever facility they had been in, the community, the Office of Mental Health Services, and the board. So we see that, as well as family members and parents and guardians of these children. When the youth is released, as I said, they would have a conditional release order, and I think as Ms. Holmes-Hain indicated, one of the beauties that we've found of the system that we have currently is that the board has the legal authority, if an individual were to violate that conditional release or their mental health were to change or decompensate such that they pose this danger to others, the board has the right to immediately revoke that conditional release and teletype the police to pick up that young person and take them back to a hospital, thereby avoiding any untoward event. We don't have to wait for something bad to occur before we can intervene and get them the additional treatment they may need. So with these safeguards, we believe, as the Law Commission and the work group, that this approach and model balances the need for public safety with the rights and needs of these young persons who have serious mental health difficulties and could provide the care and treatment that all parties seek for them. Thank you.
You very much. At this point, I think I'll say that if we want to move this bill because of our quorum issues, we're going to have to get it out by probably 5 minutes to nine. So I don't want to put pressure on anybody because we need to get this information on the record. But just be aware of. We'd like to move it along the process today. So with that kind of stifling comment.
I just want to, Mr. Chairman, if I could ask just one question so we can get the record established. You mentioned the child or the young person's rights. I know that the bill deals with victims' rights of notice and also regarding registration. Could
yes.
you go over those two things just real briefly so we have the record for that?
Madam Vice Chair, Mr. Prince, the statute does provide as that we provide notification to the victim and any party, frankly, that the court orders the board to notify, and that would be throughout the course of our jurisdiction. They would be notified of any hearing before the board involving the youth.
The other question was registration. If the youth is found within the jurisdiction of the court as responsible, except insane, for what would constitute a sex crime, if it were committed by an adult, then they would be subject to sex offender registration like an adult, but also relief from registration through the juvenile code, which we think is an important piece of public safety protection built into the bill.
Thank you.
And Mr. Prince, we currently do that and assist our clients in the adult system with the registration piece as they're released from the state hospital.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Carrie Rasmussen. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Vice Chair Burdick, members of the committee. My name is Carrie Rasmussen. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County at the Juvenile Department, and I recognize that I have about 5 minutes to speak, so I will try to keep this quick. The state, through the Oregon District Attorneys Association, just cannot support this bill. The main concerns are the fiscal impacts. Just a couple of examples, and I'm referring to the co-chair's 2003-2005 budget proposal that was just released last week. You'll note in the public safety adds and cuts that we're looking at a $17 million reduction in indigent defense special purpose appropriation. When you look at Rob Patridge's form, that contemplates that for the next 2 years, we are not going to have any indigent defense lawyers for PCS methamphetamine cases and non-person misdemeanors, all non-person misdemeanors. Moving down this list, this also proposes that we totally wipe out juvenile crime prevention grants. I could go on and on with other examples of just how far we are, frankly, gutting the criminal justice system. And in this time, this of fiscal urgency, Oregon District Attorneys Association just feels that we really can't afford what is perceived as a fix by some and not necessarily by others. And again, I'll address that briefly in that I think we need to step back and look at what exactly probation is in the juvenile context. The juvenile system is completely different than the adult system. When a juvenile gets a probation officer, the whole juvenile code is reformation oriented. It is not geared at punishing a juvenile. In fact, the introductory paragraphs to the juvenile code speak to that. And I spoke to several juvenile probation officers, many with over 20 years of experience, and their concerns about this bill were that they feel with the resources, the very limited resources that they have now, that for these kids that do get adjudicated delinquent, that they are doing an adequate job. They stress the importance of developing a community-based relationship with that child. When you're looking at community safety, you also have to look at years down the line, and these probation officers said that in their experience, and they have, you know, three or four times the amount of experience I do as an attorney, that when things are transferred to a board, there's less personal interaction. Right now, the judge retains jurisdiction in these cases and can order all appropriate counseling and therapy needed. The judge herself, I say herself because it's Judge Abernathy in this county, develops a personal relationship with these youths. They come back for review hearings before the court. So there's a fear that what this bill does is it transfers jurisdiction of the child to a board. And the fear is that jurisdiction not remaining in the county will stifle that personal relationship. And I do recognize that we have to move on. Unless there's any other questions of me, our general fear is the fiscal impact. One other point I do want to make with that, the number of 10 children that we've been looking at, District Attorney's Association thinks that it might be higher than that. A psychosexual evaluation costs at least $1,000 to $1,500 or more. A thorough psychological evaluation costs even more, and a neuropsychological evaluation costs many thousands and involves sophisticated testing. The language in the bill provides that if we have a hearing on this matter, that the state simply will have an evaluation. So we're looking at multiples of thousands of dollars that none of our offices can afford to spend at this time for these hearings that we frankly feel aren't necessarily fixing something that's working right now within a lot of counties. I don't think that there's been a lot of analysis, at least the Oregon District Attorney's Office Association hasn't seen detailed analysis as to what's working among counties and what isn't working. The perspective from Marion County is that it's working just fine here.
Okay, but to get the record straight, your primary concern is the fiscal concern.
Primary concern is the fiscal. Right.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Thank you. We'll have brief testimony by Susan Russell and Angela Kimball is already signed up. Do you two want to come up together? Welcome to the committee.
Susan Russell, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, I know we're pressed for time, and I'll be very, very brief. We are here in strong support of Senate Bill 887, which addresses a very specific gap in the juvenile law. The bill is a result of hard work and concerted effort by various participants in the Juvenile Code Revision group assigned to address this issue. Ingrid Swenson from the OCDLA was one of those participants, and we strongly support the result and of that hard work, the dispositional alternative created by Senate Bill 887, a juvenile panel of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. We believe that the bill skillfully drafted to address existing gaps in juvenile code concerning the treatment of a youth who has successfully asserted a mental disease or defect defense, taking into account both the needs of the youth and the needs of society. Thank you for the opportunity to support the bill.
Are there questions? Thank you.
Vice Chair Burdick and members of the committee, my name is Angela Kimball, and I'm here as a constituent of the Vice Chair as well as a parent of a child with a serious mental health disorder. I'd also like to present some written testimony in support of Senate Bill 887 from NAMI, Oregon, of whom I'm a member. But at this point, I'd like to urge you personally to give your full-hearted support of Senate Bill 887. I'm the mother of two teenage boys, one of whom is a 16-year-old who was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and ADD 4 years ago. But all his life, I knew that something was wrong. When my 16-year-old was still a toddler, I had a thought that no mother should have. I worried that on his 16th birthday, he'd be in McLaren. I wondered this because he did not respond in the way other children did to requests, to explanations, to discipline, to ordinary routine and ordinary life and love. I didn't admit this to anyone because I was ashamed of having this thought, because I loved my son more than anything in the world. I struggled for years with counselors, with behavior management techniques, with parenting classes. I stayed at home so I could manage his behavior. I prayed that he would mature. But instead, he got bigger and angrier. He made little eye contact, he spoke little, he was hard to control, and his responses were unpredictable. He'd be sweet one day, withdrawn another, and inexplicably enraged another. We never knew what would be broken, who would be hurt, or when this would happen. We walked on eggshells, and then in fifth grade, my son's teacher said, "Angela, honey, I've taught hundreds and hundreds of kids, and I know when a boy is misbehaving and when something is wrong. And something is wrong. You just keep looking for help You'll know it when you get it. A couple months later, we were able to see a child psychiatrist. This man saved our lives. He told me to throw away the parenting books, and he believed my son. When my son told him, I want to be good, I just don't feel like I can. He asked my son to try a medication just once and let him know if it helped. The next day, my son came home from school and said, Mama, my head doesn't hurt anymore. I never knew it hurt. I just wanted to slug people all day long. And now I can kind of ignore them. It took 2 more years to get a combination of medications that stabilized my son's bipolar disorder. And before he was completely stabilized, he entered adolescence. And he ended up in the back of police cars. He was charged with a crime, and he was put in a diversion program. I was ashamed. I felt like we had failed. And I worried because we were perilously close to losing my child to a detention facility. My son has always been an enormous challenge to those around him. But I'd like to point out that life itself is a challenge to my son. He's betrayed not just by his thoughts and his emotions, but by other subtle disabilities as well. It was just last year that a new version came out of standard intelligence tests. And these tests showed what I had always suspected. My son, who is very bright and articulate, measured extremely poorly in 2 key areas, sequencing and processing speed. What this means is that my son gets extremely frustrated by requests that require more than one action or response. He simply can't process those multiple steps without time and help. And simple sibling fights take an enormous amount of time and patience in order to help him remember the sequence of events and work through the emotions that seem to overwhelm him. Imagine what life must be like for him. And imagine what others think when an otherwise intelligent and articulate youth refuses orders, doesn't admit to a clear pattern of events, and lashes out in anger. It's tempting to think that he's defiant and delinquent, not disabled, not mentally ill. But he is both. And I'm grateful every day that my son wasn't in McLaren on his 16th birthday. Instead, he's in a public high school in a special program. He smiles, he has friends, he goes to school every day. I never dreamed that he would get this far, that he would simply enjoy life. Please give the youth who suffer as my son suffers the chance for treatment, not criminalization, the chance for hope, not regret. This is only just.
Thank you very much for coming. At this point, we are waiting for a quorum so that we can take a motion. I appreciate your coming, and especially as my constituent. And I appreciate you for coming and keeping your comments short. Thank you. Okay. We are in work session. Senator Walker.
Yes, Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 887.
Senator Walker has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 887. Is there objection? Is there comment? So ordered. Senator Walker, I would appreciate a motion. Yes. Along these lines.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 887 as amended with a due pass. Recommendation to the Ways and Means Committee.
And that the bill be Senator Walker moves that Senate Bill 887 be reported out with a due pass recommendation as amended, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there discussion?
Just a comment, Madam Chair.
Senator Walker?
I appreciate the concerns raised by the District Attorneys Association. Because we are in a tight budget, but clearly we have a deficiency in the system, and I think if we put this down in Ways and Means, they can work out how this might fit within the overall budget. But I think this bill is certainly a worthy piece of legislation that we need to move forward.
And just to explain where this bill is going now, if this motion passes, it will go to the Ways and Means Committee, where it will be considered as part of the overall budget. It's a very difficult situation for reasons that the District Attorney's Association pointed out. But I also wanted to commend the incredible amount of work and hard effort that went into this, and really to praise the people who participated in this. Is there objection to the motion to refer this to Ways and Means? So ordered. Okay. Thank you. We will proceed as a subcommittee of the Judiciary Committee at a public hearing on House Bill 2277. Paging Council Joseph. Oh dear. Senator Ringo, you put a glitch into the process here.
I did. I'm here.
I know.
Let me see.
We didn't know when you were coming back, so we had to send the minions out for very early.
I have
well, he's got two witnesses who have to get out of here.
Well, I talked a little bit about this.
We'll recess for about 3 minutes here while we hunt down our council.
I think we forgot his cell phone. We're just telling you.
Hearing on House Bill 2277 and House Bill 2645. And we have somewhere a sign up. Maybe we should take a screed from our council. Mr. Joseph.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bills 2277 and 2645 deal with domestic relations proceedings, specifically the enforcement of multiple support orders. Typically what happens in these cases is the parties can end up appearing before the court in different jurisdictions or a number of different times in the same jurisdiction, and there's the possibility of entry of multiple orders regarding the same child. Be they for support or visitation or otherwise. These two bills are trying to create procedural mechanisms by which the court will be made aware of multiple judgments so that the court can create a combined single governing judgment that will set forth all the rights of the parties in a single judgment to reduce confusion, increase efficiency, and hopefully increase the effectiveness of such judgments. And I understand that Wendy Johnson is here and Mr. Kanagi is here, and they have hopefully still have a witness with them who I understand had to leave at 9, but we got to it as quickly as we could.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission. We have today Sandra Hinsberger, Oregon Law Commissioner, appointed by the Oregon State Bar, Professor Lewis and Clark Law School, who chaired this work group for the Oregon Law Commission, as well as Rennell Schenkel from the Department of Justice, who was on the work group, works for the Department of Children's Services, I believe is the correct title. They'll provide the testimony to explain the bill.
Thank you very much. Come on up. Now, will you be testifying on both of these bills, or do you want to do one at a time? Or
good morning, Vice Chair Burdick and Senators. I'm Sandy Hansberger from Lewis and Clark Law School and the Oregon Law Commission, and it probably would be best to do them together because they really are companion bills.
That's fine. We're in hearing on both of them.
Great. Thank you. Briefly, I think the overview that was given by your committee counsel is pretty thorough and straightforward. These are companion bills, and the purpose is specifically to address the problem that's created by conflicting multiple child support orders. The difficulty, as you are probably all well aware, with child support is that it's a fluid set of facts with, you know, the facts of the parties changing constantly. And so it's difficult to apply sort of standard law principles in determining which order is valid. So through the work of the Oregon Law Commission work group, and we had some, there's a list in my testimony and the commission report about the members of the work group, we were well represented by district attorneys, by the Department of Justice, state court administrator's office, and private practitioners. We came up with two proposed solutions, one which is House Bill 2277, which is to prevent conflicting child support orders from occurring in the first place by requiring parties to plead when they come before the court any existing orders. So we're hoping to prevent courts from entering conflicting orders in the future. Secondly, House Bill 2645 is the bill that really does create a mechanism for resolution of those conflicting orders. Just a brief historical note about the work of this particular work group. The problem was brought to the Law Commission by the State Family Law Advisory Committee and from practitioners and SFLAC noticing that this was a problem in family law that needed to be resolved to create a much more efficient and streamlined process and to reduce and eliminate the confusion that was existing in the judicial system and to some extent the administrative process. The bill passed unanimously through the work of the work group and also through the Oregon Law Commission. And unless you have questions, maybe Linnell would like to say something, but I'm happy to try and answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Are there questions? Ms. Schenkel?
For the record, Ronelle Schenkel, Department of Justice. I will just add a couple of pieces of information. Sandy has given you a good historical perspective. On House Bill 2277, to put it very simply, what will occur is whether or not you're in the administrative process or in the judicial arena, if you're going in on an order that will contain child support, you will be required to file a certificate saying that you have checked to see whether or not only are there any other existing orders, but are there any other existing legal actions pending. Our goal, again, as mentioned, is really to make sure that those two forms are coordinating and communicating. And if we happen to have one person come into the program because they're receiving welfare and they're getting services there, and at the same time there's a divorce decree pending, we want our two forms to work together and enter one order and not two. On 2645, I'll just point out to you, that's the bill that then says what do you do when it happens anyway, and two orders exist in two different counties, or perhaps one in the administrative form and one in the judicial. Probably the simplest way to look at the process we worked out in it, and it was a long time with a lot of attorneys looking at how we could make this work for everyone involved. There are some flowcharts, I believe, attached to my testimony that walk you through the steps fairly simply and show you all of the details that will be taken care of. But basically the end result of that bill is that if there are two orders, there will now be statutory direction to tell us which order becomes the governing order from that point forward, and we will eliminate those ongoing multiple orders that are running against families. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Is
this a thoughtful process that is similar to one that's existing in other states?
Chair Burdick and Senator Ringo, it's a combination. We looked at other states. We looked primarily, I think, at Washington, had quite the same scenarios that we were trying to resolve, but we also looked at the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, where you have multiple orders in multiple states as a model.
Texas and Iowa had some history and tried to address some similar problems, and what we found was that their particular solutions didn't apply necessarily in Oregon because Oregon's administrative process seems to be much more fully developed and more fully used. And so the occurrence of the problem coming up in Texas and Iowa was somewhat different than it is in Oregon. Also, one of the problems that does exist, and
exists probably more in Oregon than it did in Texas and Iowa is just the computer systems that are available to track for the courts to be able to be informed within different counties of the state about the problem.
Madam Chair? As I look at, I'm kind of surprised this problem exists, though, because it seems to me that it would be in the interest of the litigants to tell the court that there's another support order out there. Maybe not in the interest of one of the litigants, but then very much so in the interest of the other. And I'm wondering why that hasn't taken place.
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, you have hit the nail on the head. Sometimes one party is preferring the other one forum over another because of the way it's playing out for them. I think, as Sandy mentioned, you can't necessarily tell if there's an existing order, and I think a lot of this occurs because you don't have a final order in either forum, but you've got two legal actions running. And so the parents don't think about the fact that there's something happening in that other forum because they don't have an order yet, and they don't understand how that will play out.
And also, if I may add something, Senator Ringo, one of the problems that exists in this particular forum, and I'm sure you're aware of, is that we have a lot of pro se litigants. And we don't currently require them, in the judicial forum at least, to notify the court of other pending procedures. And as Rennell said, you can have a party who's a pro se person participating in the administrative child support forum and also have a divorce action going on or a custody dispute or something else pending in the circuit court and not notify the court simply because they don't know the court needs to know. And the high incidence of pro se litigants or unrepresented parties, I think, adds to the particular confusion here, and that's why this kind of clarification is needed when people actually file their actions.
Madam Chair?
Senator Ringo.
Is there a reason to think that a pro se litigant would be aware of this new law?
Chair Burdick, Senator Ringo, I believe they will. If they're pro se but not filing on their own, they're working through the child support program, they're definitely going to get the information. If they're pro se and filing directly into court by themselves, the Judicial Department, the State Court Administrator's Office, was involved in this work group, and it is my understanding that they have some number of pro se forms available on their website, and I assume that information will be updated there so that they can obtain this.
Melissa Sislak, who's with the State Court Administrator's Office, worked closely with us, and she's here, and I'm sure happy to answer any questions, but it is my understanding that forms will be made available that will contain that particular certificate that's required, and that's a big piece of the puzzle.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, great. So, does anybody have concerns over these that would cause us to want to hold them over? Okay, at this time I'll go into work session on House Bill 2277.
Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move House Bill 2277 to the floor with the House recommendation.
Senator Ringo moves House Bill 2277 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Ringo, would you like to carry that?
Sure.
Work session on House Bill 2645.
Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move House Bill 2645 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2645 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objection? So ordered. Senator Ringo, maybe we should carry both of these since they're related. Thank you. Okay. Okay, shall we just go with 2262 and have your time over here?
I think we should.
Okay. We'll now open a public hearing on House Bill 2263. Joseph.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2263A prohibits the issuance of hardship permits to persons whose driving privileges are suspended for failure to appear, pay a fine, or obey an order of the court. And typically what happens in these cases is somebody fails to appear for having a violation for driving while suspended or has a fine imposed against them, fails to pay the fine, and later comes in to try and get a hardship permit, which is a permit to allow them to drive for purposes of work or to pick up their children or something of that nature. And right now, they can, as I understand it, get a hardship permit for those purposes, but they still haven't paid the underlying fine or appeared in court. And this bill would simply set forth the policy statement that if these people aren't willing to come forward and at least pay their fine or simply appear in court in the action, whether or not there's a conviction or whether or not there's a plea, just appear in front of the court, they should not be able to take advantage of the hardship provision. And I believe that Ms. Taylor is here to explain further the bill.
Okay. Kelly Taylor? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. And we did bring this bill forward because, as Mr. Joseph explained, people are using the hardship permit law to legally drive while avoiding their responsibilities to the court. They are getting a hardship permit. They are spending $125 to get the permit and paying for higher insurance to do so and avoiding paying for the ticket or showing up in court to even appear. We felt that it was an unintended loophole allowing people to avoid their responsibilities. Mr. Carl Myers could not be here today. He represents the justice and municipal judges, and he spoke in favor of the bill. This bill, 2263, will say you need to go to court, you need to settle up, either be found guilty or innocent, not avoid the ticket, not avoid the fine. And I want to let the committee know that they will, courts allow people to make payments on tickets. So it isn't that they have to pay the whole ticket in whole. They would just need to at least go to court and make arrangements for it. If they don't, then they're suspended, and that would be the incentive for them to go back in to settle up. The bill was seen favorable in the House. It passed unanimously. All people that were there that day voted in favor of the bill. I would ask the committee to support the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions? Senator Ringo.
Good morning, Kelly.
Good morning.
I mean, the problem I have is I think you're just going to be encouraging people to just drive without a license.
Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, most people do go ahead and show up. There is a small number. There are a few thousand people that don't show up. And the reason they don't is because they're allowed to drive legally. We believe that since the majority of people, when they get the suspension notice, which is a 60-day notice, I should let you know, it gives them 60 days to go in before they're ever suspended to settle up. Since the majority of people are doing it, we believe that it is the minority of people that are avoiding it. And when they find out that they're not going to be eligible for hardship to avoid it, that they will go ahead and settle up also. You're right. There are some number of people, no matter what we do, no matter what policy you put in force, are going to drive without insurance, are going to drive without a license. But we believe since most people, when they get the suspension notice, head in, the minority that are using the loophole of a hardship will then also go in and settle up.
What's a hardship permit for?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, excuse me?
I'm sorry, who gets a hardship permit?
Madam Chair, Senator Ringo, anyone is eligible for it, for this type of suspension. They fill out a form, they pay $125 in fees, they file an SR-22.
What type of suspension?
Madam Chair and Senator Ringo, most suspensions have this. But the point of the policy of suspending for failed to appear, failed to pay for a fine, is that supposed to be the incentive, the threat of suspension, to get you to go to court to settle up. By giving the hardship permit, you simply allow them a way to circumvent going and drive legally. A hardship permit allows you to drive to and from work, on the job, to attend alcohol and drug treatment. Frankly, if they just would go to court and settle up, they'd have their full license back. They wouldn't need a hardship at all.
Can I make a comment? I mentioned picking up children. Is that part of the hardship permit process? You didn't mention that. I just don't want to give a misconception to the committee if that's not one of the reasons that you can get a hardship. For instance, an unemployed but single parent or parent who needs to pick up children from daycare, that type of thing.
Madam Chair and Mr. Joseph, I would need to check statute. I don't believe just going to pick up a child at daycare or something is one of the legitimate reasons. However, taking a family member for medical treatment when you're the only transportation available is something that is allowable.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I mean, I don't know what to think about this, just because I think that, well, first of all, I'm very frustrated by the level of people in our society who choose to drive without a license, without insurance, and they just ignore it. And as we've heard in other hearings, we have little ability to stop that. Impoundment is not a good mechanism, and we heard testimony, people drive while suspended, they're arrested, and 2 hours later they get another ticket for driving while suspended. And to me, when somebody's trying to get a hardship permit, that's an indication that they're trying to do the right thing. And if they weren't even trying to get a hardship permit, then that would indicate even a step, one more step of irresponsibility. So to me, here you've got somebody, they're trying to do the right thing by getting a hardship permit, and we're making it a little bit more difficult for them.
Madam Chair and Senator Ringel, let me give you a little bit different angle on that. They are trying to get the hardship permit because they don't want to show up in court on a ticket that is probably more serious of a fine than $125. They are, by getting the hardship permit, they never are found guilty on that ticket. That ticket never goes on their record. They never pay the fine. They can outwait the court and drive legally. So what this bill is saying is you can do the right thing and put that $125 towards the payment of your ticket, and the courts do allow them to make very, very small payments. They simply want them to come in and own up the responsibility. So if they were truly trying to be responsible, they would go to court and show up on their ticket.
Yeah. Madam Chair. Kelly, I'm not really trying to give you a hard time, but I just am very frustrated with the lack of a solution for people who drive without insurance, without a license, with a suspended license, and it seems that there's nothing we can do. And this, I mean, this relates to that problem. So sorry to beat you up a little bit on this.
Madam Chair and Senator Regal, I agree with you. And I think that it is those kinds of tickets, the bigger tickets, the driving uninsured and everything, that people are not showing up on, so no sanctions are happening to them. They're simply able to drive legally and never be convicted of the driving uninsured that's got a heftier fine, and never be suspended for that, never have a problem. You can have multiple fail-to-appear, fail-to-comply tickets on your record, and none of them will ever, you'll never be held accountable because you can drive legally on the hardship. That's the point of this bill, is to make them go own up to the fact that they were driving uninsured or driving while suspended, instead of letting them just off the hook by saying, here, you can have a hardship permit and drive legally. That's the point of the bill, to try to get at that.
Okay.
Thank you. We've been honored with the presence of Representative Jensen.
Madam Chair, excuse me, but I...
Representative Jensen, forgive me. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 2263 and open the public hearing on House Bill 2263 and open the hearing on House Bill 2262.
Madam Chair, I wanted him to testify on that.
Well, that's just too bad, Senator.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, please indulge the poor representative from Eastern Oregon today. He forgot his ears at home, and this morning when he rushed off to the Capitol with the to begin a very busy and hectic day. So if you have any questions, please shout them at me, and it'll help me a lot.
Okay, the first question is, will you please introduce yourself for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very good. I am State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58. That is the populated portion of Umatilla County. Not all of Umatilla County, but the populated, I would say, portion of Umatilla County. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2262 comes to you because of an event, a tragic event that appeared on I-84 in 1999. You will recall, I'm sure, from the papers, the discussions of it, and from the television coverage, there was a huge dust storm. And we had a multiple car pileup on both west and eastbound lanes of I-84 in almost exactly the same place. There were several deaths that were involved in this, and the outcome was of that all of those people who were involved or who were at the accident site had their driver's license revoked. And this is more or less consistent with existing statutes. I became familiar with one problem because a constituent came to me, like that they do to all of us. And my constituent, a lady from Stanfield, a single parent with a couple of children, working at a job that was just slightly above minimum wage, had been at the scene of this accident. She, however, was in no way a part of the accident. She merely had the misfortune of choosing that time of day on that particular day to go from Stanfield to Pendleton. In fact, she did everything right. When she got into the dust storm, she slowed down. One of the trucks that was in the accident had its speedometer pegged at 65 miles an hour in zero visibility. But this lady, excuse me, slowed down, and when the visibility became impossible, she pulled completely off of the freeway. The only damage that was done by her was her car got dinged a little bit when she took out one of those very expensive little reflectors alongside of the road that help us all as we're driving at night. But for her good driving, she had her driver's license revoked. Suspended? Revoked?
Suspended.
Suspended, excuse me. The net effect was she didn't have the $800 that counsel in the area told her that they'd have to hear her case. And she couldn't afford not to have her driver's license unless we wanted to put her on welfare and have her stay at home instead of being working. She needed her car to get to work. She obviously needed her car to be able to transport her children to their activities and so forth. In desperation, she came to me after she had exhausted what she thought were all of her other avenues, and I entered into a long series of negotiations and discussions, some of which I would admit were not necessarily cordial, as far as I was concerned, with the department. 22 phone calls, and 6 weeks later, we finally did reach what was basically a temporary resolution to the problem that allowed her, and I think probably some other people, though I'm not familiar with them because they were not, they had not come to me, who did nothing wrong to get their suspended driver's license back. I want to thank the department. My initial intention, as my ire was, when my ire was up, was to just bring a bill down to the legislature and make the case. And override, if you wish, the department. But the department promised me in good faith that they would work on this issue and attempt, to bring resolution, a meaningful resolution to it. And I'd like to thank the department for doing that. And that's the reason that you have this bill before you today. And I assume you will invite. Well, it's public testimony, but I assume you'll allow the department to make comments on this, because if you get into the specifics of the law, they will be much more qualified to speak about that than I am. And thank you very much, Madam Chair. I'd be happy to answer any questions
that
you have.
Thank you for coming. Questions? Again, Kelly. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor, Department of Transportation, and as Representative Jensen told you, there was a multiple chain reaction accident. I mean, there were many, many cars involved in the accident up on I-84, and the police reports that we got in came in different pieces and were confused, and it took us quite a while to sort through it. But the way the current law reads is if you cause or contribute to an accident, I've gotten here in my testimony, under certain circumstances, including unlawful operation of a vehicle, and you cause injury, death, or serious property damage, you are to be suspended. And the only discretion that we have is to take an immediate suspension if that person would pose a future endangerment to persons or property. What the bill does, it does a couple of things. It removes injury and property death out of it because, frankly, we don't get the injury reports to know how serious an injury is or to try to figure out what somebody's injury is. And property damage has been something that nobody's ever gotten their arms around. But death, you know, when you get the reports, you know what's happened. What this bill does is it says we may suspend. We may suspend if there's death, and we may immediately suspend if we believe the person poses future endangerment. It gives the department flexibility when they get the different reports in to sort through them and say, okay, this one doesn't merit it, and this one does. The due process still stays intact. If it is the may suspend, it's a 30-day notice. The hearing is held before the suspension goes into effect. It can be stayed until the hearing is held. If it is the immediate suspension, it would be a post-suspension hearing, but it would be held quickly. So the bill is to get at something that has been a problem. The I-84 accident was a perfect example of how we get reports in and we have to take actions based on the reports and then you try to sort through it. It gives us flexibility, so we're not having to suspend. This bill was heavily supported in the House, and I would ask the committee to support the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay. Well, perfect timing, Senator Ferrioli. We will close the hearing on House Bill 2262 and go into a work session on House Bill 2262.
Chair.
Senator Ringo.
Move House Bill 2262 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2262 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? So ordered. Senator Ferrioli, would you carry that bill?
Madam Chairman, since I was absent from the debate, I will carry it if you're requesting to, perhaps one of the other members of the committee might be better to carry it.
No, you leave at your peril, Senator Ferrioli.
I will be happy to carry that bill, Madam.
Thank you very much. Senator Jensen came to testify on it. Maybe you could consort with him. Okay, we will open the work session now on House Bill 2263.
Senator Chair.
Senator Ringo.
I move 2263 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Ringo has moved House Bill 2263 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Objections? So ordered. Who would like to carry this? Maybe we should have Senator Ferrioli carry this one.
Madam Chairman, I'm here.
Okay. There you go.
Be punished twice for the same.
Senator Ringo got the first two on the agenda because he was gone. So you get these two. Okay, now we will open a public hearing on 2332.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2332 is a bill that Representative Tom Butler introduced for a constituent, Ann Roop. Ronelle Schenkel's here from the Department of Justice. She's probably the most knowledgeable person in the room, unless someone from Representative Butler's or Ms. Rupp is here. If not, this bill deals with support enforcement payments, and there is a section of this Oregon Revised Statutes which provides that a person parties to a support enforcement judgment. Usually that money goes to the Department of Justice, but there can be an election to have it going directly to a checking account of the obligee, the person who's getting paid. This bill would allow for a electronic transfer from an account be transferred to an escrow agency, just like it's the same escrow agents that we use to buy and sell houses, and they would be handling it, and this would be at the election of the parties. So I hope Ms. Schenkel's available to fill in any blanks.
She has indeed signed up.
For the record, Ron L. Schenkel with the Department of Justice. Our department worked closely with Representative Butler and his constituent, Ann Roop, during the interim on this concept. And counsel has adequately described to you, it is true that according to the Code of Federal Regulations and then the Oregon Revised Statutes, any orders new or modified after January 1994, the way we collect child support is through income withholding, and payments have to go through the child support program's statewide disbursement unit. There is currently one existing option that the parties, if they're not already receiving program services and they agree in writing or the court orders that they can pay through bank accounts, this would add a second option for the licensed escrow agents. They would be paying through those agents as long as they stay current. At any time, the parties could choose to come into the program for services and income withholding. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, can I ask one?
Counsel.
I think I should ask the obtuse questions for the committee because I'm confused by one thing. In the bill, I just want to make sure I understand this. In Section 2, it says that the parties can elect to do this type of thing unless the provisions of ORS 25.020 sub 1 apply. I know that's the general support enforcement. Is that saying that if subsection 1 applies, you can't do this election?
Chair Burdick and Council, yes. If one of the parties has already asked for or been referred into the program, they cannot then have this account set up because they're already running through the state disbursement unit.
Okay, a follow-up question, Madam Chair. So this would be prior to having the Department of Justice and the Support Enforcement Division having to be involved. They could do this election forestalling that.
Chair Burdick and Council, that's correct. I believe Ann Roop anticipates this would mostly be in dissolution cases where they don't have a need to come into the program and would like to have an alternative outside. It is possible that you could have a case in the program, and as long as there's no money owed to the state and both parties are willing to cease our services, that they could later go. But the anticipated group are those folks not yet in the system.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there other questions? Any problems on the committee with this bill? I see no problems. We will close this public hearing on House Bill 2332 and open the work session on House Bill 2332. Do I hear a motion?
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 2232 to the floor to be passed for recommendation.
Actually, 2332.
House 2330.
Senator Starr has moved House Bill 2332, and we're having trouble with that today, to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion? Objecting? So ordered. Senator Starr, would you like to carry this?
Love to.
Thank you. Okay. All right. We're going to put, completed work on most of the bills, and we're going to put House Bill 2319 and House Bill 2322 over until Monday. With that, the committee
It'll be Tuesday because Friday's not a work day.
It will be Tuesday.
No, they're already on the schedule.
They're already on the schedule.
Okay. Somebody anticipated this. So if there's no further business, the Senate Judiciary Committee is adjourned.
I remind the members that you have a 10 o'clock floor session.